how did you get into science fiction? I mean, it's still more male readers who are into science fiction, because normally it is just quite hard technical stuff and normally badly written, with characters not really developed. So when was your first encounter with science fiction?
Well, I grew up as like a geek or a nerd. I love Star Wars. Do you love
really?
Star Wars?
You're really one of these stuff.
I went to the Star Wars Celebration Japan last April. You know how they have Star Wars Celebration?
It's completely madness as far as I know.
And what do you call that? I love Andor. Have you watched the Andor series? I met Diego Luna.
Really?
And the director, what's his name again? Tony Gilroy.
Yeah.
Who writes one of the most amazing speeches in science fiction television. So, I grew up, my parents, both of them are doctors.
Okay.
So a lot of my family members are into science. I mean, a lot.
All right. And you come from an educated background.
Yes.
Then with literature and films around you.
No, I'm a marketing major.
Yeah.
So, I mean, I love creative writing ever since I was a kid. But I do love business too, so that's why I took up advertising.
So you have two souls within you, but of course one is for making money as well, isn't it? Because
still writing, but it's really more of writing commercials, and radio spiels and doing marketing plans. But the same discipline is used in creative writing, but one is more of like informative, right? Buy this now for only €2, right? Get the most, nothing beats a Jet 2 holiday, like that, right? And the other one is more of science fiction, world building and everything.
Yeah, of course, I mean, many film directors started with commercials. Look at Ridley Scott, I mean, for example, I mean, he started in commercials as well. I mean, many of them did, and you can still see it in the films, in many of the films and some of the books as well. I mean, that's not something very different in the end. If you're good in commercials, you're normally good in writing literature.
Yes.
it's possible, yeah.
Or like the other way around. Wait, here, I'll show you where we start. This was the Star Wars Celebration. So they had a whole pavilion for it here in Japan. So this is in Chiba, the Makuhara Messe.
Yeah.
The large thing. And then they had all of these, like these, every hour someone from the Star Wars, like an actor, would come out, like if you would have panels that day.
Yeah, yeah.
And I was so lucky to meet Christian. Hayden Christensen.
Okay, really? Wow.
Oh, he's so near. he still looks like how he looked like from Revenge of the Sith.
A little bit
older. But then you realize when they're not acting, they just look like regular people.
Isn't it? Yeah, isn't it? It's funny, isn't it? When you meet actors, actually, it's completely different.
Yeah, they just look like regular people.
It's really. I have a friend who's a film director, and sometimes invites me to the set of his films, and then I'm always surprised to see these famous actors just having a coffee, and I approach them. Oh, excellent! Come on, let's have a coffee. And I say, well, this is so. It's a completely different world, man. I mean, it's.
So it was really fun. So there, we saw the Andor panel, and then there were a lot of cosplayers doing the Narkina 5, the one where they're in prison. And then they did a prison run. They ran through the entire thing. So yeah, it was really great.
Fantastic. So I mean, when did you really think of writing science fiction? I mean.
So when
did it start that you really not only did read or watch Star Wars or whatever, then starting to write about it?
I had my first ever, ever since I was a kid, I would write sometimes just on bond papers, you know, that way you staple it together, pretend to make a book when you were very young.
Yes, I know.
And then I had my first foray into actually like novella writing when I was very young, maybe around 12. I actually wrote maybe a 35,000 to 40,000 word novella. But it was unpublished, but it was called The Star Seekers Chronicles. It was already sci-fi.
It sounds like.
And I had inklings of it when I was a kid. Like, so funny. I found my old drawings and, you know, the stuff that I would just write on paper as a kid, they were all science fiction.
So the drawing always went parallel. I mean, it was always there as well, this comic kind of expression.
I would make comics. I would even make print ads, like the new super scooter, hovercraft, like that. Like, I would write ad copy. But they were all machines. Like, there was one, it was like the Typhoonathron 3000. So, right, the Philippines has lots of typhoons.
So I
built this big machine before that would capture the storm and then throw it away. But that was like at 7 years old.
It's interesting, because when I thought your comic sketches, your drawings, they reminded me of some of the French comics. Like, yeah, you maybe you know this by Pierre Christin and Mézières, Laureline, and...
No, but I think I know Mobius.
And it is Valerina Laureline. It's one of these classic French comics. And when I saw you, I thought, wow, this is similar, because it's a woman as well, a kind of hero, and also this Tex-Mex stuff, it's there. I was really amazed. Very, very nice. But so what came first in publishing, the comic line or the?
I actually have something for you.
Really?
I would be so happy to give you a copy of Tablay.
Oh, really? Fantastic.
And this is the preview issue. Well, the full book, we're making it in time for Frankfurt this year.
So, oh, really? You make it fantastic.
Just 2 weeks before we fly off, it's
really?
In to come out. So that's going to be its first appearance. So it started out as Tablay, which was the book.
Yeah.
Well, even before this, I had another science. It's more of steampunk, you know, the steampunk genre.
Of course,
genre.
I know steampunk, yeah.
So it was called Skies Above. That was my first ever one. But what it was is, you know, as Filipinos, we grew up consuming so much Western media.
Yes.
Right?
Yes.
Especially like the US, Disney.
Of course,
Nickelodeon.
Yeah, yeah. Same Germany, I tell right? you. I mean, it's
on Cartoon Network. So I guess a lot of our history was really revolved around these things. So of course, when you see a lot of the especially first time authors in the Philippines, it's really more of that copying habit that they want a lot of Caucasian characters. I mean, because that's what we grew up with,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
And then, so my first story was a white male lead, but of course they had a whole cast of characters with different ethnicities. But I was proud. That was really my first book. But when I entered the comics community, I didn't realize that there was this entire ecosystem of local creators that made proudly Filipino works. Like,
oh, interesting.
All the characters are Filipino. Like, oh my goodness, if you had more time, I would have loved to like show you what the local scene really is like. Like, we're mostly backyard builders, you know, very zine. Very zine, especially comics. It's a very zine kind of startup society.
Okay.
Where everyone literally just uses their own printers to print out their own comics.
Really? So it's really analog. I mean, they don't go digital. I mean, they just don't, or do they do it as well?
For the ones that want it, like at comic cons and comic-ettes, it's very analog.
Yeah.
We just go to the small shop printers around town.
Oh, really? And then you print it out?
Just to have... You know, most comicer, we call them the comiqueros, is the local term for comics creators. They print out a limited batch of just like 20 to 30 copies. That would happily be a bestseller for a local a local event if that sells out, which tells a lot about the, I guess, the infancy of the market, right?
That's great. So, it's fun, yeah.
But those are the small, I would say, the indie pubs, right? And then we have the bigger guys like the Wattpad, stars that get picked up by the bigger publishing houses. And those are the ones that would really have these events where, you know, they would close down the coffee shops, they would invite their fans, maybe have book signings, readings, mall tours, press tours in the mall. So those are, I mean, they're overlapping circles, but they're different like subgroups of the same writing community. So the web famous stars who got famous through Wattpad and webtoons on the internet, and then another group of people that are really just like the small shop builders that have these weekend events like Comic-Con, Comic-Con.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
The indie zine pub market, so
interesting.
They all coexist.
And it's just a kind of hobby for them. I mean, they can't live from it, isn't it? Yeah, they all have normal jobs beside that.
Mm-hmm. Because, I mean, as a, well, in terms of comics, it's really not sustainable yet.
Yeah.
So most people, like me, I have a day job.
Yeah.
It's like the closest thing to writing books is writing ads and scripts for TV.
Yeah.
And only you have like a god client that's like, no.
Yeah.
Make the product placement longer on this thing.
Yeah, it's true. When I'm a film critic as well, and from the film critics, I get little money. But of course, for festivals, writing short descriptions, and this is or press releases, this pays ten times what I get for a film review. And this is ridiculous because, of course, it's so much more energy writing a review than writing a normal ad or write. So it's how it is. I mean, that's,
I think it's like the balance out.
Yeah, exactly.
Like your day job will fund your passion.
Yeah.
Which funds your day job, which funds your passion.
Exactly.
So right. So going back to my first book, which was a steampunk fantasy, I got exposed to the local community. And I was like, wow, I want to make something that really leans into my own Filipino roots. Because I was so inspired by the other creators. Like, what, they had Filipino characters. They weren't like wanting to be like the US or wanting to be like Europe or Japan. They just wanted to be Filipino and tell their own voice stories. So I was like, okay, I want to try something that's similar to that. But you know me, being a marketing professional, we have this term called the blue ocean strategy. Have you ever heard of that?
No, not sure. No, I don't think so.
This is just like a hybrid of my mind being like a creative writer and at the same time being a marketer. What's something that I like, but so this is the ocean, right?
Yeah.
The red ocean is where everyone's competing. Mm-hmm. Everyone has the same story.
Yeah.
Everyone's writing romance. Everyone's writing fantasy. The blue ocean is this wide frontier that no one has tapped yet.
Yeah.
And it's science fiction. Because if you think about Philippine literature, who exactly has written science fiction in Filipino literature?
It's right. I'm really quite new into Philippine literature, but what I've seen through our magazines, the short stories that have been sent in are such a diverse field. Mm. I mean, you can't say this is Filipino literature.
Yeah.
It is just, very diverse. And but as you said, I mean, I never have come up science fiction, I mean, in Filipino so far. So this is a good idea to have a unique selling point.
Yeah.
I mean, the blue ocean is this unique selling point,
exactly,
isn't it?
Exactly, yeah. And I mean, it was just so natural to me because I did love science
of
fiction.
Course, yeah.
I wrote it. So
yeah.
I was like, let's lean into that. But the unique twist is, it's like, what is something that's very Filipino that nobody can own, right? That's the unique selling point. And I thought mythology, right? Because the US can't replicate our mythology, right?
That's right.
It's something ingrained within our culture. So I said, what if we combined science fiction with Philippine mythology? And let's tablay. So all of these creatures are mythical creatures that go thousands of years into the past. But I decided to put like a science fiction twist to it. Like the tikbalang is like a werehorse. So we have it's like a werewolf, but instead of a wolf, it's a horse. So it's like, it's a bipedal creature. So if that was turned into a mech, it would be like a speedster, right? Like it's like a cavalry unit. Or the tik-tik, it's a flying, in the lore of Philippine literature, this tongue, so tik-tiks, they stay on the roof, especially in the province. And whenever there's a pregnant woman, the tik-tiks are attracted to them. Then they use their tongue to siphon out the fetus.
Oh, really?
Just like,
what a delicious meal. What a delicious meal.
just like suck out the fetus from,
yes, of course,
from their wombs.
Yeah, so quite a...
The Capre, they're like tree-dwelling giants. But in the original lore, these Capres are like giant gorillas that have, they have a large cigar. which they smoke.
Yeah.
So there, but here in Tablay, so I was like, smoke. So it's always transposing, like what is
yes,
in
yes,
the,
yes.
What's
in
the plot the, twist?
Yeah, right? What's in the middle of the what you're doing out there,
They're like exhaust. I imagine them as like heavy artillery units.
Yeah.
And because their bodies are so heavy and they carry so much heavy fire, the smoke would be like exhaust coming from the machine. The Nunos, they're like gnomes. They live underground. But in Philippine literature and lore, it's like you have to say tabi tabi po. I don't know if you're not familiar with Trece, the anime, the comic anime that became a Netflix series. You have to say tabi tabi po, which is like excuse me or pardon me, I am passing by.
All right.
And then if you don't do that, the gnome's gonna get angry and pee on you. It's like you disrespect me, I'm a piss on you.
Of course,
you,
right? Yeah, I understand.
So in Tablay naman, the transposition of that is it's like a subterranean trapper creature, like it's a drill, because like the gnomes have the hats, right? So here in those, it's a drill head.
Yeah.
And he's like mowing through the ground, and he has like landmines. So they all play like this whole orchestrated like system of enemies that the mech force has to fight. So this is our main characters. Her name's Anya. She's a mech pilot. And then her robot is called San Telmo, which is also a Philippine mythological creature. San Telmo is like a wandering spirit that's like a ball of fire. So the San Telmo mechs are very heavy powered, fire based.
That's really interesting what you make out of the mythology, because we have one of our stories from the Philippines is from Alain Duran, and then of course he uses a lot of mythology, but he goes, of course, for him it is he stays very much in the traditional way, and he only transforms it very little, I would say. But this is extreme. I mean, is very nice. It is.
Yes, feel free to browse those are your copies. I would be happy to send it later.
This is great. I will read it. And by the way, I mean, if there's any chance, do you have maybe a science fiction short story in your drawer? Because I mean, if you have, I mean, we would be happy to publish it with us in our magazine, because this is, we have such a diverse set of Filipino stories, but I've never had anything like this. Just have a look. I mean, something like 3,000 to 5,000 words. Okay. I mean, so in this range, if you have it, would be great.
Oh,
we would be happy.
Okay. I do have some in my back pocket. Maybe I'll.
Yeah. Just take a look.
And, okay.
This is great. This is fantastic. What I find interesting as well, I mean, I haven't read it. I mean, I'm always feel a bit guilty talking to somebody, some author whose books I've read. I mean, when you write your books, is there any, do you have any political issues in your back mind as well when writing? I mean, is there something in this book? Because when I look at all these American science fiction authors like Philip K. Dick, of course, they were reflecting current American issues, Vietnam War, whatever it is. Hidden, of course, it's always hidden in the text. So are these mad political situations in the Philippines, like Duterte or now Marcos Jr. and all that, is this in your writing as well?
Okay, so I actually wrote Tablay and published Tablay in 2016 to 2020, which was the height of the Duterte administration.
Yes.
I had strong feelings about extrajudicial killings. It was very, I mean, there's a lot of injustice, right?
Yes.
And I think there's a lot of undertones reflective in the book, but not necessarily about that point in time, but there were a lot of long-standing, I would say, societal, socio-political issues that you can see in Tablay. But back then, I guess I wasn't as brave. I mean, that's what the graphic novel is for. It's always remastering the work.
This is a good point, yeah.
Remastering the work to make it more real. It's like when we reboot superhero movies, right?
Like,
the Superman of now with David.
Have you seen it?
Yes, I have seen it.
It's brilliant, isn't it? Mm-hmm. I mean, for me, I think it's the best Superman. I mean, because it's the most present one.
Yeah.
Because it is.
It's made for this generation.
Exactly, and it tells so much about today's politics, of course, about all that. Yeah.
And I think I like I like David. I mean, sorry, I like James Gunn, Superman.
Yeah. Because James Gunn is fantastic. He
has a proper understanding of the. He's not like the Snyder that would kind of like, you know, macho. I mean, I loved Henry Cavill. Thanks so much for that. But the essence of it is to like give hope and not to be like this, you know, this badass.
That's right. And then
there's different translations, you know.
But yeah.
And I think he nailed. This one.
That's right. It's quite brave the way he is political, the way he shows. I mean, what Elon Musk is, and it's all in this movie.
Lex Luthor,
it's all there.
Even and, the Palestinian
exactly,
or Ukrainian
exactly,
thing.
It's all there. And then in the very funny way. I mean, you can laugh about it and you can think about it. So it's possible in both sides, and that's it's. You were not that brave to put it in that clearly, right. But it's...
There are some, because I, like I said, I was just starting out in the comics community. And I wasn't as open, meaning, you know, I'm like, what if I say this? What would something happen? Right, I mean, especially during that time. Mm. It would be, there are instances where people get red tagged, meaning they'd put a flag on you and saying, you know, you're against the government, obviously it wasn't... I'm still very cautious, but of course I really wanted to have a message about the things happening in our country. So that's the beauty of science fiction, right?
You can
beautifully package it in this futuristic setting while also talking about the current zeitgeist of society now. Yeah. And there's a lot of issues that get brought up here. It's like there are issues on historical revisionism.
Yeah.
There are issues about indigenous people there's a lot of lands here that are sacred to the indigenous people. There are a lot of corporations that that grab the land and turn it into subdivisions, mining factories. Yeah. So there's a lot of environmentalist issues also in the book. There's issues about the West Philippine Sea, right? A lot of hot issues that are packaged in a way that they're quite subtle, but it's really talking about the Filipino people and what are the struggles that we have today with the political divide. Because in Tablay, there's the Mech Force, because it takes place in Manila, 100 years into the future, and the Mech Force are, there it is, the first page. This is, you know, Intramuros, right?
Like, yes.
So this is new Intramuros, which is like an expanded version. It's the whole Manila that is walled. And then beyond it, right, we have the Aswangs, which are the monsters, right? So we have the Mech Force, which is like the military. Well, the whole city is like a junta or like a military, you know, based system. It's an oligarchy. And we have the Aswangs on the other side. So it's this whole battle of what is true, what is right, what is humane. So the whole premise of Tablay asks us, what good is progress and technology if it is made at the expense of our humanity?
And that's a good point. It reminds me of the Botswana author. She's a female as well, and she wrote an amazing science fiction. Her name is Tutelo Tsamatse, and it's called Womp City. And it's the same. She transforms the mythology and current issues.
Oh, wow.
Exactly the same way. It's a great book, and it's in English as well, available. It's great when you. I think it's not. I think it's a bit like a successful. It's when you have good Netflix formats. I mean, they tell you something about the local issues, but they transform it into something new that is readable for a wider
audience. Yeah, exactly.
That is right. Yeah.
I think one of my mentors is Will Sportacio. If you're familiar with him, he works for Marvel. He was one of the Filipino diaspora authors who traveled to America to start the. Actually, there are a lot of famous Filipinos in Marvel. They're just not as spotlighted as like a Jim Lee or Will Sportacio. He created Bishop from X-Men. He's Filipino.
Okay.
And we have a lot of Filipino artists that also did. Like right now, there's like Steven Segovia. Who else? There are some cover artists like Mannix, he's part of the delegation, who else, Miguel Mercado, but so there are a lot, there's a lot. But what he told me is, what he realized, this is him as a Filipino-American, which was so interesting to me, because as a mainland, when I say mainland Philippine, like I grew up here, I was born here, versus diaspora creators. Their focus, I think, is really finding their Filipino roots, right?
Yeah, it's of like course,
when,
yeah.
When you're displaced and when you've grown up in a in not your own habitus, you're always trying to find like, who am I?
Exactly. What,
my home, my homeland, my roots. And he was telling me that he noticed, well, this is from an outsider's perspective. He noticed that a lot of Filipino, and I'm going to transition to that, a lot of Filipino books feel closed. You understand? Like, they're writing for a Filipino audience. Well, maybe because we're still getting there. We're still on that way to proving that we're worthy of a world stage, if you understand what I'm saying.
Yeah.
I'm just writing for a local audience, because I don't, and this is a very global South, this is a very Filipino thing now. I think we have this own imagined ceiling that we have to break, because as Filipinos, we think, oh, because we're Filipino, we're only up to here. We'll never be as good as Americans, or will never be as good as Koreans. And I mean, that's exactly what I'm trying to smash the glass ceiling for that, you know?
This is a high approach. I mean, I would say it's because, I mean, when I look at German literature, I mean, normal German authors never think that wide. I mean, they are somehow stuck in their language, in German language and German culture, and only a few look beyond.
So we would be the same in that way.
That's right. But this is a good thing, I think, about a culture like yours with a lot of migration, a lot of diaspora. I mean, this is, we don't have people living outside Germany, not many, because there's no reason to migrate. They are rich, so why should I migrate? And this is, I mean, always you can blame it. You can say, what a culture. I mean, it's such a poor life here, so many people have to
find better opportunities.
Have to go for immigration, but in the end, it gives you this opportunity to ask for more. I mean, to ask for a global audience. I mean, this is, it's interesting you tell me this, because it's the first time I see it this way. It's interesting. It's rightful. It's good.
Yeah, and what do you call that? There's this thing. It has to do a lot with culture and the fact that we're like a colony, right? I mean, we've been under Spanish for 300 years, and then
Americans and all
British.
That, yeah.
You know, we were under the British for 2 years, but they gave up. They gave up because everyone just kept getting sick, so they just all just decided to give up.
Of course, this bloody climate. I mean, that's,
after that, America, Japan, but like a large chunk of the influence did come from America, Spain. And we love a lot of Japanese things. That's why they're robots. But yeah, it's because we've always been in that sort of, we got the shorter straw in life, you know? It's always like, we'll never be as good as the Western countries. And that's a mindset that I've always seen. I mean, we don't admit it, but it's just, I'm just spitting facts, you know? No.
That's the thing, it's with every diaspora culture. I mean, they're always, even when you live in the diaspora, I mean, you always have the feeling, I'm not good enough for the culture I'm living within. I mean, I will never say, so they always work double the amount, always want to be successful double the time. So it's, you're right, it's hard to avoid.
And I think that mindset is what's also limiting the capabilities of the indie authors and the starting authors in particular. It's because, because I'm Filipino and I'm only going to aim for the Filipino audience, there's a saying in Filipino, it said, pwede na yan. So when I say pwede na yan, this is good enough. It's like, it's just mediocre and it's good enough because it's just made for some of my friends, some of my family that they're gonna read, so I don't have to take too much pains. I know there's a lot of, like, but me, I am like, even though I'm making it for a local audience, I want to make sure that it's global quality. Like, I go through all of the stringent measures to make sure that I hire, like for the graphic novel, hire a proofreader. a cover layout artist, an editor, a bunch of friends that aren't just yes men, but that can tell me that you can push the narrative this way, we can tighten, we can fix, we can expand.
Understand that.
Yeah.
Because, well, the personal dream is really just to take the book abroad, right? And take it and become hopefully a gateway for, and I've seen it happen. I launched it on Amazon, yeah. And I've seen a lot of international interest. Now, this is my first Filipino book. I found it so interesting. Can you lead me to more Filipino literature or Filipino authors? So there's this whole maybe two steps of a platform that we gotta jump. First is to combat the perception that we've made ourselves, and second is mutually to get like support both from the government and from local and private firms to actually bolster the literature. It's not even an industry, because man, it's literally just like a few passionate people who push out books.
That's it, just right. When I talk to Caroline Howe, I mean the maybe you know her. She's a researcher, a professor for Rizal and all that.
Yes.
And she said, I mean, when she looks at the typical Filipino reader, it is cookbooks and the Bible. I mean, what is read normally, and it's only, as you say, a very limited community that is interested in reading different stuff. And
but. Another challenge, I would say, well, not really challenge, but another context is that we are so diverse,
yeah.
But there's a sort of power in multiculturalism within the Philippines. I mean, there's like, what, 7,600 islands? I know, they just keep adding more islands every year. It started at, what, how many islands did we start out with? 7,100. Tapos ngayon, huh? Yeah, so they added 500 more islands. I don't know what constitutes an island. Oh yeah, the tides matter. So,
okay.
So, like, diba, you move over from Iloilo, you move over from one island, you go to the other island, it's a completely different culture.
Okay, yeah.
Because,
yeah,
I mean, in a sense that Philippines wasn't even like a cohesive nation when the Spanish discovered it. We all have our own thing. So,
yeah, because the Spanish started this typical colonial style divide and rule. I mean, and I think is it for you still that language divides the country or makes it difficult to go for a proper identity? I mean, and even as a writer, I mean, writing in Filipino is different than writing in English. I mean, it is you have a different audience.
I feel like there are overlaps in terms of culture, but the contexts of each language, well, there are over 600 to 1,000 languages in this country alone. they put different meanings to things, you know? But I think the shared experiences are the values that we all have. Like, you know, what I do love about Philippine culture, and which is reflected in all of my works, that whole sort of sense of community and family. Like, you know how, like, for example, American comics, right? The superheroes are so detached from their own family, except for Superman, well, who is Ma and Pa Kent, but
yeah,
I mean,
that's right. He's detached, and then on the other hand, it's all about family. Because I think, especially in current American society, the family is the only thing left that you can trust, because you can't trust in politics, you can't trust in the economy with all these oligarchs. I mean, so what is left? Family.
Yeah.
And so you have to get over this detachment, as you say, to find again your real family.
And like, what do you call that? I think Filipino society is very hinged on human connection. Like, for example, I have a lot of friends. I have a lot of older, let's say my parents' friends that are not necessarily my blood relatives, right?
Yeah.
But I still call them tito, which is uncle, like tio, tito, tita, aunt. Like, even if I don't know, like, sisters, friends, British ang tito, tita. Like, there's this sort of kindredness to it. And
so would you compare it to what we in the West say patchwork families? I mean, that
like found
family. Yeah, like found that. Family. Yes, yeah, it's like this. Yeah,
you can depend on them. Yeah. You have this sort of. It's a very complex thing to dissect. Like there are no exact words for it, but like Filipinos have this concept of kapwa. Kapwa, which is like the other, right? Like something that, you know, like especially in Western culture, like, oh, I don't owe you anything, right? It's so individualistic. Like I'm gonna make my own life. Like even what they did with what they did with Lilo and Stitch, that Nani had to,
a good one. Another very good film, recent film.
Nani chose herself over her family.
Yeah.
I was like, why would you leave Lilo? Anyway, but what I'm saying is the truth is we do owe people things, right? I mean, there's a sort of sense of, there's another word, utang ng loob. Well, it can be used in many ways. It's like your debt of gratitude, right? I mean, can be a double-edged sword. Some people can use that against you, like, hey, I raised you, so you better owe me this, right? Or is it just a simple, the reason that we give to each other, is it transactional? No, I mean, it's because, you know, we feel like, you know, you did good to me in the past and I just wanted to repay you for what you did. So there are all of these concepts of othership in, and not othering, but othership, meaning
you're still part of this. It's a good expression,
We're still part of this whole community, even if we don't know each other, but you know, like, are you familiar with the concept of bayanihan in Filipino? I love this. It's like a social studies class.
Yeah, I enjoy it as well. I mean,
so in the past, neighbors, we would have, these are the typical Filipino homes in the province. When people would move houses, neighbors would come together to literally lift the house.
Why did they move the house?
Why would they move the house? They just wanted to change location.
No, really?
Or maybe, let's say, the area has become too dangerous, or maybe it's too near the river. And you know what? I never realized bakit sila nagmo-move ng house. Yes, they just want to move. I guess they just want.
Just like, I want to see a new tree. A new tree, please. A new view.
They didn't have anything to do back in the day, so they just wanted a change of view. So
of course, yes.
Let's move from the base of the mountain near to the sea.
Understandable.
And they're literally your neighbors carrying your house.
That's interesting.
With you, and they don't know each other, but they just, you know, like when someone gets into an accident in the street, it's not like a miracle, like, no, we don't want to get involved, or like, we might get sued if we get into that. No, it's like people will literally like jump in and help you or get into a fist fight with you if it came to that, because even if we don't know each other, we still owe people something, you know.
That's interesting. That's always community as a, it's a, what we would call a patchwork family, extended family. Yeah.
And that's what we see here in the books too. It's like, we see people suffering and we don't understand completely what's happening on the other side, but it's natural for us Filipinos to empathize. I mean, that can be a bad and a good thing, right?
And is it never a burden as well? I mean,
it is a burden as well. There have been discussions, well, this is already going past books and more into like Filipino society in general. There have been discussions, like there's this weird law that was placed recently that if you don't take care of your aging parents, you can be jailed.
Really?
That's so weird.
Really?
Yeah, I mean, I know that we have the sense of, you know, entitlement, that, or the sense of like we have to reciprocate because our parents take care of us, but there's this ongoing discussion that would you really do that? I mean, you're not owed that sort of debt, but you can get jailed for not taking not taking care of your parents.
Interesting point. I mean, we have this discussion as well. I mean, yeah, in which way are you responsible for your aging parents? I mean, what used to be normal is not normal anymore. I mean, that you take care of them because you're living far away or whatever.
Or let's say you have to transfer live with your new family.
Exactly. And it's always a bad habit to give them to aging houses and all that. Yeah, of course. But it was never a discussion, of course, to get fined.
Get jailed.
That's an interesting topic. That's okay.
But yeah, it's just like Filipinos are very community centric, and I guess in the sense, parang people pleasers, but we go with the herd and not with the head a lot. So because we're a very community based people, and that's like in the book. So Anya, she's a rising star in the mech force, right? Mm. She wants to be the best mech pilot ever. Mm. She finds out this dark secret about the fight with the Aswangs that totally changes her perspective on the war. Mm. And then she realizes this is not right. Mm. But like, what's the right thing to do? Are you going to turn against this whole system that you've grown up with? Mm. Are you going to turn your back on your lifelong dream? Or are you going to like expose the truth about this horrible war? The people suffering. So there's this I don't have the picture of it, but they're developing this bomb called Bakunawa. So that's a central point of the story. They have to stop the creation of this mega weapon before it's too late. Mm-hmm. So it's a race against time to try to, you know, bring adversaries together and show them that the only way that we can win is together, and not because the Philippines has been so polarized too. In the they're starting to copy all of the Western sort of politics. That if you're not with us, you're against us. There's no gray area that you're allowed to be in. This sort of coloring of your politics kind of divided. Yeah, society a lot. There's the right now currently in the Philippines, there's the BBM-DDS, so the current administration, and the people were against it. But of course there are different factions and whatnot. But it's, you know, I wrote Tablay in 2019. You know, I thought it was just like good versus bad, right? The evil people versus the good people.
Exactly.
But this is where, you know, I've grown up as a person. You come back years later when I was writing the graphic novel, and you realize that the concept of good versus evil doesn't really exist. I mean, it's a very nuanced, right?
Yeah.
Like in war, it's more of varying shades of gray. Yeah. I would say than someone is completely evil.
Yeah, yeah.
Someone is completely good, but we all as people have the capability to do good and evil things.
Yeah, yeah.
And it's just a matter of what is in alignment, diba, with what you believe is right. What is objectively right? Is it to kill, diba? Is it, does the end really justify the means? The road to hell is paved with good intentions, right? So it's really a balance of figuring out and breaking generational curses, right? I think that's another theme of Tablay. History might have dictated the present, but the future is what we decided to be. So we have to choose it for the good. We have to choose to create a future for the good.
That's right. But when I look now at real terms, at reality, it's how would you explain that the last elections, the son of a former dictator has come to power? I mean, I think many young people did elect him. We have similar tendencies in Germany. We lots of young people have voted for a Nazi party, and so it's all over the world. I mean, this pattern. But how would you explain the pattern locally? I mean,
it's very complex too, because aside from the fact that there are still, right, even if we did say the dictatorship was gone, there's still a lot of people until this day that benefit from whatever that person built during this administration.
Exactly.
The Nepo babies and the cronies and whatnot. And, you know, that's even more alleviated by the fact that as a global South nation, we're highly driven by money. And so a lot of the things we're
Yeah.
I'm gonna give you this, I'm gonna give you that. The troll farms that were created, all of the systems that were all, even all of the Gen Z people who were like under that party list, they're all paid to do these things.
Yeah.
And I've heard interviews where of troll farm leaders.
Yeah.
They still voted for the person that they wanted in the good. They just had to make money to make sure this guy won, but they still voted for the candidate that they really wanted.
Really?
So it's just like money makes the world go round. And,
in a real radical way. It's interesting.
So I mean,
do you have personally any vision out of it? I mean, for example, there has just been published a book in German, the biography of Joe Massey, former communist leader.
Okay.
And is this still important for the younger generation, these old concepts of
equality and socialism?
Another leftist.
There's still a lot of progressive groups.
Yes,
especially, of course, they're hitting towards, you know, the super mega corporations and the capitalism. The government, right? Inconsistencies and stuff like that. But I feel like with all this globalism happening, like a lot of people, well, there's a lot more empathy still, like, and cancel culture, right?
Of course.
Such a big thing everyone's afraid that if you make one wrong statement or one wrong move, everyone's going to gang up. It becomes like a trial by the masses.
Yeah, exactly. It's just really hard.
That's why I guess a lot of people are still borderline conscious on what they say. That's why they wrap it and package it in these beautiful, or, you know, what medium is very political is comics and zines, because I do know for a fact that there are a lot of leftist groups that do make a lot. Well, it's cool. Like, there are some. What do you call that? There are some groups that their main thrust is the progressive groups. Their main thrust and how they communicate is through comics, and that's what they disseminate to the masses, through the communities. But there, of course, there are different levels, right? Some are grassroots, some are more up there. But it's like, they use comics as a medium to disseminate their message too.
Interesting.
Which is interesting. And it's kind of like flyers and stuff like that.
That's fun. Yeah,
it's grassroots.
Really, and does it affect anything?
They're quite a small group.
Yeah.
They're quite a small group.
So would you think there is hope that in the near or far away future, I mean, this political issues that are current now will change to a new?
You know what's so interesting? The most recent elections did show that there is a shift
for the good. Oh, really?
Because usually a lot of Philippines is anti-political dynasty by law, but unfortunately,
it's like the United States. I mean,
it's the cracks. If it's not the main guy, it's his cousin. If it's not his cousin, then it's his like sister's the cousin, and then you just draw a map of it. You see the matrix. They're all just distantly related to each other. Just like a Game of Thrones, right? They're just all playing a large family game.
The
dragons dance and everyone else is like smushed along the way.
Yeah.
So that is so true for the Philippine political system. But what we realized, what we saw, the trend at least, is that the political dynasties are slowly, people are becoming more conscious, right, because of the next generation.
Mm-hmm.
They're not as attached, right, to the things. They're because of, right, the globalization, because they understand that now it's important that we don't stick to political dynasties. Slowly, very slowly, but surely, the people that would usually win in the elections did not win this year.
Really? Like, was it what kind of election? So was this
local
government?
Local.
Yeah, okay.
Like this, let's say the mayor that would usually be the mayor for so many years, their family suddenly got the throne. Like in some parts, for the national elections, for like the Senate, there were some people that, well, most are still we call them trapo or traditional politicians. These are the usual slate that would come in every year regardless.
Yeah.
But we're starting to see some cracks where people from the minority or opposition would come in. And at least what I'm saying is there's a slow shift with the newer generation because they're starting to...
This is very interesting, yeah.
Gen Z is starting to realize the importance of having their voice to vote. But of course, in that Gen Z, we cannot discredit that there are still some hardcore, right?
Yeah, but this is very interesting for me that you mentioned the younger generation as a possibility to for a new vision. Because what I see in my place, it is completely opposite, different, because the younger generations are a little bit afraid of this freedom they have. It is too much freedom. So you have responsibility for everything. So they are looking, it's not a majority, but it's a strong movement. So they want to have a strong leader.
Yeah.
And that tells them do this and that. And they are happy with that because they don't have the experience of earlier generations, of the Third Reich, of the Nazis. It's long time gone. Mm. And the eyewitnesses are dead. So you're ready to experience again new dictatorships.
It's like a pendulum.
Exactly.
Super strict and then progressive.
Exactly. And with all the migration movements coming to Germany, they say, okay, this is all frightening. We are losing our jobs. We are losing that. I have to decide for that. So it's so much fear, so much anxiety. So that is the main issue, the main point for them to vote for a strong
leadership.
And that is frightening. But to see it, that it's different here, it's really hopeful. I mean, this is something very different, and I hope that this is continuing.
Hopefully. But like I said, it's just like maybe an inch. But it's an inch is better than nothing, right?
I would say so. Great.
So, I mean, there is a bit of hope, maybe some lights between the cracks.